You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Daniel Philbrick.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you've never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. We look at all of this and more from a long-term strategic view, how to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Nathaniel Philbrick on the show with me. He has a fantastic new book. It's not exactly a new book, but it is out in paperback for the first time. It's called In the Hurricane's Eye, and it's the Genius of George Washington and the Victory at Yorktown. Welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, let's see. I've always been scribbling. Even when I was in first grade, I live on Nantucket Island, and the Tuesday before Thanksgiving every year, I go into the school system and read a story to the second graders. And I brought with me a book called The Silly Book that I had, just grown up with. And I had long since forgot, but in bringing it in, I looked at the end pages, and there I had written a little joke, in my, I think, first or second grade scrawl. And it was a picture of some cats in a boat. And it said, a cat jumped off the boat, how many cats followed him? And it was all of them. They were copycats. And I said, wow, I was doing this kind of, sort of telling little stories, little jokes, way back then. So I think it's just sort of been a lifetime itch.
I love that so much. As you look back, was there ever a teacher or a parent or someone of influence in your life that might have picked up on that, noticed the storytelling gene or whatever in you?
Yeah, it was, I had a wonderful history teacher in high school, and Miss Wilt. We still actually exchange Christmas cards, and I think it was a world culture or world history course with her when I was a sophomore in high school, and in one of the papers, she said, "You are a very good writer," and it made you, it was the first time anyone had said anything about my writing, and I remember to this day. It made me realize, well, maybe this is something I should pursue.
I love to ask those questions of people because, a writer's life is full of ups and downs. And sometimes there are dark days where it seems like the story's not coming. And, it's a slog. And having those little things to pull back and remember. And I think it's good for us to look for that in other people, too, to pass that encouragement along.
Oh, absolutely. And as you said, it tends to be a solitary profession, and you can work yourself into the worst possible psychic places just through natural human paranoia, let alone the difficulties of putting the words on the page. And it's really useful every now and then because, everything I write, there's at some point where I have a sense of, I don't know what the heck I'm doing here. It's important not to lose faith, but remember someone like Miss Wilt who saw something, promising, because it is a tough one. And in terms of keeping up the faith in yourself sometimes.
Yeah, I love that comes from Miss Wilt for you, a history teacher. And, sad to say, history teachers seem to come in one of two flavors. They are either the coach or someone at school that gets stuck teaching history, and it becomes a class full of rote memorization, and everyone hates that class. Or you get one of those dynamic teachers who actually makes history come alive. And history class almost becomes, an education in storytelling as much as it is learning about where we come from. What do you think, was it about her that that made you want to open up in a way that made her give you that compliment? What was it that she did as a teacher that really captured your imagination?
Well, you know, she was interesting. You know, I looking back, this was in the 70s. I thought of her as already fairly long in life, but when I look back, she was probably in her 30s, and had actually had a program on our local PBS station. You know, the Channel 13, the same one that gave Mr. Rogers his start. And so she had experience beyond the classroom. She was kind of zippy. And she just, you know, she wasn't the usual run of the mill high school teachers. And so for me, and I was a tremendously shy kid, and I it was just very difficult for me to speak in any kind of public situation. And there was one thing where we had to give a presentation to the class. I just avoided it. I ended up being the last person, and I was absolutely terrified when I went up and I stammered, but got going and delivered my whatever. And she said, "Well, Mr. Philbrick, you don't say a lot, but what you say is very of great interest." And you know, once again, it was just like, "Wow, okay." So I was, I'm still devoted to Miss Wilt. I can't call her Joanne, which is her first name, because she will always be Miss Wilt. But, and I have to say, I was in Pittsburgh speaking, this is years ago, back in 2006, speaking about Mayflower. And I was interviewed by the paper and told the story about Miss Wilt. And they found her. She had retired, and she came to the talk. And it was just meant a lot, I think, to both of us. And as I said earlier, we have been exchanging Christmas cards ever since. And, it's the great goal, I think, of any teacher is to have a lasting impact on your students. And boy, she did on me.
That is fantastic. Did your love of history come then, or had you already been a fan of historical stories and events? What was it that, because looking at your published works list, it's a fantastic list of these great narrative nonfiction books. And that's, in reading, In the Hurricane's Eye, that's what really strikes me, is that the book reads like a novel, and it's almost one of those guilty pleasures you don't have to feel guilty about, because it's great, entertaining reading, and I'm learning something at the same time. I'm filling in gaps that I didn't know were there. Where did that love come from for you?
Well, Miss Wilt gave me praise and motivated me to write, but history wasn't my primary interest. I was an English major in college, and I have to say, most of the history courses I took just didn't click with me. I was fascinated with novels and poetry, and out of college, published quite a few poems and things like that, and worked for a magazine and things like that. But it was, I was more of coming from the literature perspective. And it was actually moving to Nantucket back in 1986 with my wife and our two little kids. I was at home with the kids. My wife was an attorney, and she was the breadwinner. And, I was trying to be a writer, but if you're at home with two little kids, one and four, it's pretty all-consuming and very hard to actually get anything done. But when my young son, Ethan, got into first grade, I now had till 2:30. In the afternoon. And by that time, Moby Dick had always been one of my favorite novels. And Nantucket, of course, in the 18th and 19th century, was the whaling capital of the world. And so really through the prism of Moby Dick, I became fascinated with the history of Nantucket. And when Ethan started first grade that September, I started working on my first work of history, Away Offshore, which is a history of Nantucket. And so it was really a book about where I lived, as much as anything. I was focusing on the people. I was interested in history primarily through the storytelling, through the people, trying to create a kind of journalistic sense of life as lived in the past. And so all those threads came together with my work on Away Offshore, and it was like I was 38 years old, and it was like, wow, maybe I can actually do this. Basically, every book has led from that.
You've written these great kind of sweeping epics of early American history and the Revolutionary War period. When you began writing about Nantucket, I find that very interesting because, well, for one, we all live in places that have a rich history. There have been people that have come before us and have done great things and not so great things and famous things and infamous things. And it's right under our nose and we just never know it. In digging into the place where you lived, do you think that writing that book and uncovering that history set the stage for what you would go to do later, where the stage is broader and wider? And do you feel like that you learned skills there that have helped you in what you do now?
Absolutely. You know, because I had been an English major, I really didn't know the mechanics of writing history. And so, and what I had on Nantucket were incredible resources right, literally within a quarter mile of my house. The town building has all the town records dating back to the 17th century. Our Athenaeum, our public library, has its own collection. And then there's the Nantucket Historical Association that has log books, letters, you know, all of this stuff. And it was all there. And so I could spend hours in the archives of those various institutions with primary source documents. And then in the afternoon, when the kids came back from school, we'd go on these, they were known as Daddy's goose chases. We'd go look at the places I was writing about. And that's become kind of my method, is, going into the archives, getting that material, but also it's very important to me to go to the places, to go on those research trips. Sometimes where you go, it's very hard to get a sense of the way it once was, with a McDonald's across the street from a historic home or something like that. But always the lay of the land is important to me, just getting an imaginative grasp on what had happened in the past.
What are things that you look for? Because when digging into history and digging into places, what strikes me when I'm reading a work like you've done is that it's the little things. It's not necessarily the big, huge set pieces that make me feel there. It's the little things that tie me to the people and to their experience. What are things that you look for that when you see them, you know, okay, this is going to be the thing that anchors this story? Do you notice those right away, or is it in going over your notes?
Yeah, I keep a reading journal as I'm researching a topic, and because what I find is it's in the beginning, because I write these books not because I'm an expert in the field, anything but. I write these books because it's a topic I'm curious about, and I just haven't found a book that tells it from the perspective that I'm interested in. And so I learn about the topic, and I find that as I'm learning about the topic in that first year of research, that's when I have the gee whiz moments, I didn't know that, all those kinds of things. And I keep this log of the details, the anecdotes that really resonate with me. And what I also find is after a year or so of research, not that the material is dead to you, but you know it so well that it doesn't surprise you anymore. And so what I do before I start writing a book is I go back to my notebooks and revisit what about the material I've researched excited me in the beginning, because I think that is the closest to what my reader's reaction to the material will be. And it's sort of getting a chance to sort of revisit the wonder. when I do that, I then it also helps me establish a voice, and that's the real challenge in history, because you're using sources from all different perspectives, from newspapers to diaries, a lot of it not very interesting from a narrative point of view, and it's can sort of kill your voice, returning to those moments of wonder really helped me in sort of coming to the material in a fresh and hopefully involving way.
I like that you said that you don't approach the material as an expert, but really as a student, as someone who wants to know more and wants to get to the story behind the historical event that we all think we know. Does it begin with a question? Like, what is the first itch that you start to scratch when you're taking on a project?
Right. It's a question. It's for example, away offshore, it was, well, what is the history of my adopted home? And with each one, yes, that was Quaker Whaleman, but no, whoa, wait a minute. There's a whole story of the Native American impact, African Americans, women, you know, and inevitably what I find the preconceptions, sort of the stereotypical, views that, you know, we all sort of grow up with are not even a portion of the story. And so there's all these great surprises and it's always much more complex, dark, and ambiguous than I had ever thought. And so, you know, so that led me down that road, and it was in a chapter I talked about the Essex disaster in A Way Offshore, and I began to realize, whoa, this is an interesting whaling story, but what it really is a survival tale. Wouldn't it be interesting to tell the story of the Essex as a survival tale? And so that led to In the Heart of the Sea. And it was also while researching Away Offshore that I read of Plymouth Plantation, William Bradford's account of Plymouth Colony. I was looking for context for Cape Nantucket in New England's history. And when reading that, I realized, wow, there's a lot more to the Pilgrims than I ever learned in elementary school about Thanksgiving. And so that led to Mayflower. And so, you know, each one begins with, questions, a surprise, and, well, what is the real story?
You have written books about Nantucket, as you said, and the Mayflower, Bunker Hill, Custer's Last Stand. Now we're looking in the new book at George Washington, in a light that I've never looked at him as through a naval perspective. When you're researching these books and writing the books, which one has caught you off guard, maybe, as being the fact that the true story is maybe nothing like the legends that have been passed down, or more interesting, or maybe less interesting? I guess which one has been that the truth is much different than what we believed it was?
Yeah, you know, basically every book I go through that experience, and you know, it's funny. I think it is so easy to assume you know the story, but you got to dig deep. And for me, the real juice of the story are the primary documents, you know, what you find in the archives. And when you go to those original voices, you're hearing the actual people from the past. You're not hearing what people in the 19th century or the 20th century wanted to have happened back then. But when you go back to the source, it's full of surprises because, you know, here we are in the 21st century. We're in a very different place than previous generations of people writing about the past were. And so it means that delving into that past will be different for us by definition because we're coming from a different perspective. And so, each one of these, as the most current one, In the Hurricane's Eye, you know, I'm a maritime guy, you know, living out here on Nantucket. I love to sail and been researching maritime topics for most of my life, but I had no clue of Washington's connection with the sea. You know, we think of him as tied to a horse, but,
right.
You know, he
and
grew up on a... Yeah, a farmer, an army general, but, you know, he grew up in the Tidewater on a river. Mount Vernon is named for a British admiral, if you can believe it or not, that his brother served under. And when he was 14, he desperately wanted to be a midshipman in the British Navy. When he was 19, he sailed to Barbados with his older brother. You know, he had been to sea, he understood the sea, and when it came to the Revolution, particularly those final years, he realized that, you know, you can win a battle on land, but until he's able to establish naval superiority on the sea, he'll never be able to win that victory. And the only way to do that is with the help of the French Navy, because once France joined the war in 1778, that we had that possibility. And so this book tells the story of Yorktown. It all happened in a year, very quickly. You know, we'd been fighting this war for 6 years. Suddenly, everything clicks into place, and it's just a series of miraculous events, random events, that somehow all occur in a way that delivers us a victory based on the fact that the French defeated the British in the Battle of the Chesapeake and made possible the siege at Yorktown.
It's such a fascinating read because I'm seeing a completely different side of George Washington than I had ever seen, and you know, the book is kind of like Hornblower if George Washington were involved, and
yeah.
I love seeing this different side of things. There's a big boom right now in historical fiction, especially around World War II, and I think that that's because a lot of that generation are dying away, and we're in danger of losing those stories, those personal interactions, and the boots on the ground view of what was happening in the world then. And I think that's one reason historical fiction from that time period is so popular right now, because we just don't want to lose that. Go back another 150, 200 years, and we've got the revolutionary period, and it's to the point that whole period is reduced to, you know, a number of bullet points that we're taught about, and as time goes on, everything gets reduced that way because there's just not enough. There's more history than there's time. How do you start looking for those sources that you talk about, the original sources, and to, if someone is really wanting to dig into a period of time, where do you begin, and how do you find those sources to inform what you're going to write?
Yeah, well, you know, when it comes to the Revolution, there's the Library of Congress that has Washington's correspondence, which has been published by the University of Virginia in wonderful volumes. But there's archives for example, the Clements Library on the campus of the University of Michigan has the papers of Henry Clinton, who was the British commander during the final years of the American Revolution, along with Thomas Gates, who was the commander of the Revolution, the British forces at the beginning of the Revolution in Boston. And, you know, there you have it. You have the actual physical documents there. And then when it came to In the Hurricane's Eye, what I wanted to do was put the naval battle that really was the thing that won us our independence. I wanted to put that front and center when usually it's off stage. It's, you know, just a prelude to the big event at Yorktown. And since it was a naval victory won by the French, I wanted to dig into the documentary side of that. And it turns out many of the logbooks kept by the French captains are in Paris. At some point in the 20th century, when copying was a very primitive, pre-Xerox, many of those documents were copied and are at the Library of Congress. And so that treasure trove of logs, diaries, letters was a huge help to me. I found a wonderful translator in Quebec, and together we explored this collection and provided, you know, once again, you say boots on the ground. Well, this was, you know, feet on the quarterdeck view of a naval battle that I think most Americans really don't have any sense that it was so important. But it's been rightly called the most important naval battle in the history of the world, given its ultimate consequences.
Well, it really opened my eyes to to situations, details that I just had no idea about, much less that they were so important. One thing that's interesting when you start looking at historical figures, especially someone as monumental as George Washington, we revere, we respect him for so many things, and we're taught to from an early age, and rightfully so. But when, you know, one interesting thing about writing history is that people are complicated, and the, you know, historical times are complicated, and especially when we look at them through the lens of our modern life. How do you portray a person like George Washington and so many others as the three-dimensional, complicated people that they were, and still maintain you know, respect for their accomplishments? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like the
absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, we're in a historical monument moment where, you know, we're reevaluating America's, you know, tangled legacy, particularly when it comes to slavery. And Washington, of course, was born and raised in a slave economy. And what's interesting about him is during the 8 years of the Revolution, you see him changing. You know, in the beginning, and, you know, he is a Virginia planter, a slaveholder, you know, one of the biggest slaveholders in the country. And throughout the Revolution, he sees African-American soldiers behaving with great skill and bravery on the battlefield. He has idealistic officers such as Lafayette from France telling him that slavery is abhorrent, and how can a new nation, be founded with liberty and freedom for all, tolerating slavery? You know, he's seeing all of this, and he's also someone who was very concerned about what his historical legacy would be, and he recognized that slavery was the great evil at the center of American culture, and on the other side of it, he was hopelessly entangled in it. Not only did he own slaves, but many of the slaves on Mount Vernon were owned by his wife's estate, and there was nothing he could do to free them because they were, you know, they were legally not his. And, you know, and yet, you know, he's tortured because, you know, much of his livelihood is tied up in this economy. And so, you know, at Yorktown, this great victory, Washington is the one who insists that all the African American slaves who were freed by the British must be returned to their slave masters, including two of his own slaves. And so, you know, Washington at that point is you know, the great irony is the battle that won us our independence caused the enslavement of hundreds, if not thousands, of African Americans. And so, you know, that's the beginning of the Revolution, the Civil War in many ways. And yet Washington, he's not a saint. No, but there weren't saints in the past. But at the end of his life, he was looking for some symbolic act that could send a message to the country. And in the last year of his life, he rewrote his will so that he would free the what slaves he did own directly. And when he died, the terms of that will were widely broadcast, and just as he knew would happen. And it was, you know, his best shot at saying, you know, this is the way we should go. The great tragedy, of course, is the Civil War would occur, and it would take a terrible war begin to change things. But so Washington, I think it's very important in writing about him not to shirk, not to, you know, give him a free pass on this. You know, it's complicated, and he wrestled with the issue, and to his credit, he did the right thing at the end of his life, even if it was too little too late.
Well, the book, In the Hurricane's Eye, The Genius of George Washington and the Victory at Yorktown, is full of things like that, where heroism and struggling with the human condition, you really put a human touch to the situation, to this historical event, to these historical people. Thank you so much for the the care and the love that you put into this. The book, when people are hearing this, it's available everywhere in hardback and paperback now, audiobook and ebook edition. Nathaniel, if people are just learning about you and the work that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online, look at your back catalog, and maybe follow along for news that's coming up?
Yeah, well, you can go to my website, nathanielphilbrick.com. But I'm also fairly active on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, and you know, it's I love to interact with my readers and fellow writers, and you know, it is a lonely occupation, but it's worth pursuing, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nathaniel, we're going to send everybody to see you and to pick up their copy of In the Hurricane's Eye. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's Stone Manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!" cried Agatha, appearing from the wood.
She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond. And in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.